From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, celebrated soprano Pretty Yende joins us to talk about her opera career and her upcoming part in a Los Angeles production of The Marriage of Figaro. Dr. Philip Matiba Goff of UCLA's Center for Policing Equity looks at the issues that contribute to racial profiling. And Anne Heche tells us about her starring role in a new murder mystery TV series set against the backdrop of modern-day Jerusalem. But first, the increasingly high cost of living is making life miserable for low-income residents in major cities throughout the nation, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, and, of course, New York. Mayor Bill de Blasio wants to reverse that trend. He joins us from New York to talk about his plans to decrease poverty, increase affordable housing, and address other quality of life issues. Mr. Mayor, an honor, sir, to have you on this program.
My great honor, Tavis. Thanks so much.
Let me jump right in talking about some of the things on your agenda that you've already started to advance and to move on. Of late, you've been talking a lot about the issue of housing and always about the issue of poverty. What have you learned since being mayor that you might not have known before, might not have been aware of so acutely about the link, the connection between housing and poverty?
Yeah, the more we've looked at income inequality and the more we've looked at the challenge almost half of our city faces, 46% of New Yorkers at or near the poverty level, which is a staggering concept, almost 4 million people. Mm-hmm. What we've found more and more is that you have two ways you can address the problem: raise wages and raise benefits, which is fundamental, or bring down the cost of living. This is one of the most expensive cities in the country, and housing's the number one expense. So the more I've been at this work, the clearer it becomes that a very aggressive affordable housing approach is necessary if you're going to go at income inequality. It's literally quintessential to addressing the income inequality crisis in this country. Our plan, 200,000 units built or preserved over 10 years, enough for almost 500,000 people, the most ambitious affordable housing plan by any locality in the history of the country. And we're going to need every single one of those units given the affordable housing crisis in this town.
How do you do that without negatively affecting the housing market in the city of New York?
Well, the fact is that with the cost of housing as high as it is and demand as high as it is, that we actually are confident that even while we're building all this affordable housing, there's going to be a very strong market at the same time. And we need a lot more market rate housing, too. This city's 8.4 million people now, but the projection is we will get to 9 million or even more by about 2040. We are constantly growing, literally the largest population we've had in our history. So I don't think we have that danger of creating a situation that'll hurt the market dynamics. I do know if we don't create affordable housing on a massive scale, this will no longer be an economically diverse city. The magic of New York City historically over generations, an open city, a city for immigrants, a city for strivers, and people work their way up from the working class, that's not going to be possible if we don't address this affordable housing crisis. And if we don't have an open city, a city for all, New York City will not have that sort of secret formula that's always made us so great.
Illustrate for me what New York City looks like a decade, two, three down the road if you aren't successful with this, when you say that it won't be a city for all cultures and races. What's the city look like in a few decades from now?
If things were just left the way they are, status quo, you would see an increasingly exclusive city. I think, unfortunately, you're seeing this in a lot of parts of this country starting to happen more and more. People being forced out of urban neighborhoods and gentrification, mm-hmm. which is a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. Gentrification has some good and bad elements, but if it's not countered and balanced with smart public policy to create more fairness, you're going to have a lot less economic diversity. You're going to have whole swaths of the city that are effectively exclusive and economically exclusionary. And that's not going to be the same New York. That does not fit with our values as New Yorkers. I don't think it fits with American values either. And I don't think New York City would work if that's what happened.
To those in your old neck of the woods, Brooklyn and other parts of the city, who think that gentrification doesn't have two sides, it only has one side, that the culture and the diversity and the texture of certain parts of that borough are changing because of gentrification, to those residents of the city, you'd say what?
I come from Park Slope in Brooklyn, which is one of the neighborhoods that's arguably gone through the most gentrification over the last quarter century. One thing I say objectively, a lot of the historic culture of the neighborhood, a lot of the residents who were there a long time are still there. It's not like you flip a switch on and off. Mm-hmm. You have to address it. And so what I'd say is, you know, if you look around the city, some neighborhoods have gone through a lot of transformation. Their core character is still there, I think, in the vast majority of cases. You can preserve that economic diversity. You can preserve that mix of cultures if you act now. Mm-hmm. Now, you think about what's a way to act. Enough housing for 500,000 people, a lot of which will be in the very neighborhoods where the gentrification has already happened or might be happening next. That's a coherent response. Fighting to make sure that there aren't landlords kicking people out because they want to make a buck. You know, we have rent protections in this town, but a lot of times they're ignored by bad landlords. We're going to be much more aggressive on enforcement and providing legal assistance to people who live in affordable housing to protect their right to be there. If you do those kind of things, you can preserve that balance and that mix. If you don't, you have the kind of gentrification that runs so rampant that then a neighborhood is no longer recognizable.
We talked about housing. Let's talk about the other issue that you raised, Mayor de Blasio, that being the issue of raising the wages for workers. What is the narrative that you hope to write in the coming months and years about minimum wage? Can you raise it to a living wage? And why is it that the minimum wage is being raised in cities across the country? I can name some. You know them better than I do, but we can't seem to get a handle on it at the federal level.
So on the federal question first, I mean, the paralysis in Washington is well established. I'm hoping the 2016 election will change that. But the fact is, there's a growing consensus in this country on the need to raise wages. We even saw in some red states a referenda passed in favor of a minimum wage increase. I think the people understand that we're in an unsustainable place. If we don't address income inequality and if we don't raise wages and benefits, this country will truly be in danger. It's not a sustainable economic model that we are falling into right now. It won't be a strong and cohesive society. I think a lot of everyday Americans get that all over the country, but a lot of members of the House and Senate don't, particularly those from the Tea Party. So right now, the Washington situation is stuck. At the local level here in New York City, we have the power by executive order to address the living wage issue, which means where we subsidize a company with public funds, we expect a living wage. It starts now at $13. It'll escalate up to $15 and more over the next few years per hour. I want to have a minimum wage for the whole city that starts at $13 plus. I need the power from the state government to do that. The state government has not been willing. And I think all minimum wage should from now on be indexed to inflation so that working people are not subject to political whims and having to wait for legislatures to vote, but automatically see their wages increase as inflation goes up.
I'm glad to see you working so aggressively on two of the issues I think have to be addressed if you're going to reduce poverty in this country. In my work, I've said repeatedly that I think now, Mayor de Blasio, that poverty is threatening our very democracy. I believe that poverty is a matter of national security. So I think you're right to address the issue of wages and certainly to address the issue of housing. But it still begs the question why in such a great city like New York, and here again, I'm not naive in asking this, but in a great city like New York that you oversee as the mayor, why is poverty north of 40% for your residents?
I think it is a structural reality we have to overcome over time. I think it has everything to do with the diminishment of wages and benefits now over decades, the fact that there has not been a responsible federal policy nor state policy to turn that trend around. Now, some of what's happening here has to do with the cost of living, and that's been to some extent because New York's become a successful place where more and more people want to be. That's driven up the cost. But I think the core problem comes from the lack of policies to protect people economically. Instead of progressive economic policy, I would say since Reagan, we've really been on a downslide, and even places like New York have been negatively affected by it. You know, you could talk about the impact of technology on people's jobs. All those manufacturing jobs that used to be here aren't here anymore. You could talk about what globalization has done. I think those are very real issues. But the biggest mistake, if you will, is that federal policy and policy of states all over the country started moving away from, I think, the successes of the New Deal, for example, that helped raise people up economically and provide them with a constant opportunity to grow economically. Those policies got put in reverse starting in the 1980s, and we're paying the price for it now very grievously.
As much as I love talking to you, I got one more question I want to ask. One last piece of this poverty puzzle that I want to get to in the time we have left here. We talked about housing. We talked about the minimum wage becoming a living wage in your city and beyond. this issue of homelessness, as I see it, as I've been talking about it, I see this homelessness creep, if you will, where these numbers of homeless are starting to inch up in this society, in our country once again. In New York, there is some politics on this issue. I know you have one way of approaching this. Governor Cuomo has another way, and the two of you are not in lockstep at the moment on this issue. Tell me the story of homelessness in the city of New York right now.
It's a very painful story. We're at the all-time high in terms of the number of people in shelter, just under 58,000 people in shelter as we speak, which is unacceptably high. More and more children and families than even a decade ago. I started working on this issue about a decade ago. It used to be homelessness was a phenomenon you thought first and foremost single men, many of whom either had a mental health problem or a substance abuse problem. What's happened over time is the problem has become more and more economic, families forced out of affordable housing, or they collapsed economically because of the Great Recession, and nowhere to go. And so we're changing a host of our policies to address this situation head on, particularly to try and keep people out of shelter, either give them the legal services to avoid eviction or give them rental subsidies, which is a smart and modest way to help people keep some economic continuity and stay in their home. The state government has not been helpful enough. In fact, the state government this year in Governor Cuomo's budget actually suggested cuts to the support that the state provides to the homeless. We're working hard to reverse that. But I can tell you it is caught up in all the other things, the Great Recession, the cost of housing in this town, and the lack of federal and state policies that actually provide people with an economic future. And we're trying to arrest this bad phenomenon very quickly, but it is not disconnected from these other problems in our society.
Mayor de Blasio, I know you got a full schedule. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it. Hope to do it again sometime soon.
I look forward to it, Tavis.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The celebrated soprano Pretty Inde took an unconventional route to opera stardom. She started her career with gospel songs instead of arias. In fact, she didn't even start studying opera until she was a teenager. Before long, though, she debuted at La Scala, and now she's in Los Angeles to appear in the LA Opera's production of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. My conversation with Pretty Inde begins in a moment, but first, let's hear a selection from her Metropolitan Opera debut from 2013.
I cannot wait to see you in person.
Oh.
I am so excited about you being in L.A. Welcome to our city.
Thank you so much.
And we're delighted to have you here as part of L.A. Opera's Marriage of Figaro. How did this happen for you, your being here in this production?
I have always wanted to sing Susanna.
Yeah.
And it has been such a long dream coming, wanting to sing Susanna, mm-hmm. because it's one character that I knew that I needed to do, because she is an actress, mm-hmm. but she's so smart and she has so many layers that I needed her to teach me so many other things as an actress for, being an opera singer. Mm-hmm. I did The Countess when I was mm-hmm. still in South Africa, but I knew that I wanted to be a Susanna. So to be back at the LA Opera House is such an honor.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to be back and to be invited back by Placido Domingo.
Yeah. What do you hope or intend for Susanna to teach you?
Well, more about life, actually, the uh-huh. journey and the courage of a woman,
mm-hmm.
To be able to know how to actually manage what means the most to mm-hmm. you. Because she is, asked to do something that she doesn't want, because she has chosen to be, to be with Figaro, and yet the politics at the time are asking her so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so excited about her courage to stand for what she believes in, because she loves Figaro, and she will do whatever she can to keep Figaro. She chose Figaro.
Yeah.
And it's her smart also, the way she's so smart in terms of making the men feel that they're making the decisions and yet not. She's behind every trick in the book.
Oh, yeah. I see you like that part.
Of course.
is it often the case or always the case that you learn from the characters you play on stage?
Well, basically because opera is so new for me.
Yeah,
you know, I had no idea about it until, you know, I saw the ad on TV in 2001. And
right.
So the journey of learning about opera is actually teaching me more about myself as a human being. I was so surprised that as much as I thought it was something foreign, it's yet not so foreign because it's all human beings, you know, and learning, you know, different time zones. And yet, you know, we are all just human beings and going through the same things in life.
Yeah. You said two things now I want to come back to and ask two questions about. One, what are you learning about yourself from opera, from doing opera, performing?
That I'm courageous.
Yeah.
I didn't know that I could have such courage.
Yeah.
And that I can dream so much.
Yeah.
And that I'm not afraid to try. Mm-hmm. I will try and try and try again until I know that I can or cannot do it.
Yeah.
I was amazed to know that, because I come from a very loving family and from people who always showed me love.
In South Africa,
yes. You know. But I'm so surprised and so excited to see that not only do I wish to have that to myself, but I wish to share it with every person that I meet. Mm-hmm. And opera is allowing me to be able to do that.
Yeah. How did you mention your family? We'll come back to your family in just a second here. But how did you get turned on by the thought, the possibility of doing opera?
I think it's the feeling I felt when I heard the music.
You heard it when for the first time?
I heard it first in 2001.
Yeah.
I was at home with my family and we were watching TV. And there was this the ad on TV, which was the British Airways advert. And those 10 seconds of the Lakme duet just opened a world that I never knew existed.
So you were watching a British Airways TV commercial?
Yes. I'm home watching, you know, one of our normal soapies
right,
at home.
Right.
And here comes this ad on TV and I hear this music. Somehow my soul knew what it was, but my body and mind couldn't, you know, make sense of it. So I went to my high school teacher the following day and I asked him about it, and he told me it's called opera. And I said to him, is it humanly possible? Because for me, it sounded so supernatural. It was a feeling that I could not explain it. I could not touch it, but I could feel it, and I wanted you to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole quest of opera was, how can I make somebody feel this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were singing at that time already, though.
Of course, I was singing at the time, but not opera.
Right.
I was not even in a school choir. Mm-hmm. I was singing in the church. I grew up in a very, you know, church family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned to stand in front of people in the church.
Sure.
So, but opera just came in 2001. And I was so happy that the quest to do it, you know, happened. But also the talent was there because I was going to be imprisoned for life.
Yeah. You were not the first opera singer. I've had a chance to meet many over the years. I'm talking specifically now about Black or African.
Yeah.
I'm talking Leontine Price. I'm talking Kathleen Battle. I'm talking Jesse Norman. You're not the first to come to the operatic stage with this melanin in your skin, with this church background.
Yes.
And every one of these great divas has a different story. A different answer to the question as to what the church did for them that aids and abets what they do on the operatic stage. Mm-hmm. What's your story?
I think my story is, it's personal. It goes beyond the fame and fortune.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to the essence of human being, you know, because it's a gift. Music is a gift. I mean, I come from a country which is huge with choral music and music. I mean, we sing when we cry, we sing when we're happy. And so the whole essence of music as a gift to humanity, you know, it blows me away. And to be able to be part of that and not only be the audience, but be the person who's like an ambassador in a way of song, is one thing that makes me feel very important. And to be able to know that it's not only resting on me, but it's passed on, and hopefully it will live for generations to come.
Is there something specific about the Black church, the Black gospel tradition that you call upon when you're on stage doing opera, or is there no link or no
connection? There's always a link.
Yeah.
There's always a link. Who I am off and off stage is one person. It's just that it's the vessel.
Yeah.
The vessel is one. And of course, we might go through different emotions because, you know, how Susanna is and how I am can be different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There can be places where we can share common, you know, grounds, but it's the same person. For me, the music is important because the composer has put everything there. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I need to talk to you. Mm. I need to reach out to you. I don't know what you're going through. I don't know why you came to the Opera House. Mm-hmm. Because that's the beauty of the gift of music, that it doesn't require you to know Italian, but your soul knows what it needs. Mm-hmm. And that soul food music is what I wish I can be able to give to you.
Mm. I wish I knew your family, because I can tell your mom and daddy put something rich and deep inside of you. Tell me about your mama now.
My mama.
Yeah, your mom and your dad. Tell me about your family, yeah.
Well, I still have my mom and my dad, and they are still in Piet-Retief in South Africa.
Yeah.
And I have siblings. I'm the firstborn at home. Okay. And I have two brothers and a sister. Mm-hmm. It's a loving family. Yeah. I mean, we are all in this roller coaster of this journey, you mm-hmm. know, and we're pinching ourselves that it's not happening anywhere else. It's actually happening in our house.
Yeah.
And it's such a blessing.
Are there other musicians in your family? Are
you absolutely. The boys are into sound engineering and DJing.
Yeah.
The sister is studying in university classical music as well. She wants to be an opera singer as well.
So the whole family.
And she's actually more gifted in gospel music, so she's more versatile than I am.
Yeah.
But she has the mind and the brains for this, and I wish her very well.
Well, she has a great example in her big sister, though.
Yes.
A great example. Yeah. What do your parents, what do they make of how all this has turned out, this journey that you're on?
We're all just amazed that just this instinct of curiosity from me, wanting to know what this is, has opened up a whole new chapter into the, you know, to mm-hmm. the entire family. It took me away from home, took me away from anything I knew. Mm-hmm. I moved to Italy. I had to learn Italian. I had to see differently. I had to think differently, because I come from a very small town, and mm-hmm. yet now I'm all, you know, all over the world, and I didn't know that the world was so huge. Mm-hmm. So, but it's such a pleasure to see it happening, that, you know, you can have a dream and you can see it happening. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to have my family see it too. Yeah. So whenever I have shows, I try to have them over. When I was in New York, mm-hmm. my mom and my sister came. In Italy, I had my dad and my mom come for mm-hmm. the first time. And last time when I was here with my sister, she came to see it. Because I think more than this being my dream, it became a dream of the whole family, the entire nation, looking up and seeing that I don't have to be the girl who grew up in a big town mm-hmm. to be able to sit here and talk to you.
Yeah.
I can be just anyone with a dream and passion and actually possibilities happening.
As I mentioned, I love LA Opera. This is the final part of a trilogy mm-hmm. that they have done. Yes. Ghost of Versailles,
yes.
Barbara of Seville, mm-hmm. and now The Marriage of Figaro. Yeah. You close the show in this trilogy, as it were. So before I let you go, this name, I told you when you came on, I've loved your art and your name for years, Pretty Yende.
Yes.
Who gave you this name?
It's my mom.
Your mama gave you this.
It's my mom. I asked her, why didn't you say beauty? She said, no, it was pretty.
Yeah, it goes together. You have all those names that you have to say together. Pretty Yende. It goes together. We are honored to have you back in L.A.
Thank you so much.
It's the L.A. Opera's presentation of The Marriage of Figaro, starring Pretty Yende. I cannot wait to see this, and I hope that you'll join me if you can get a ticket. I hope you can. Hopefully somebody got the hookup for me. Can I get in? Can I get a ticket? Can a brother get a ticket? I will be there. Pretty nice to meet you.
Thank you very much. Very pleased to be here.
Glad to have you here.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Tests prove that black boys are often judged as more culpable than whites or Latinos, and their age is overestimated by an average of 4.5 years. Black children may be viewed as adults when they are just 13 years old. Professor Philippa Tiba-Goff has long studied how those social and psychological underpinnings have spurred violence against young blacks by police. He's president and co-founder of the Center for Policing Equity at UCLA and joins us now to share his findings.
Thanks for having me, Tavis.
There are many who believe, and I'm sure this won't be the first time you've heard this, that it is, where policing is concerned, open season on black boys. Is that an overstatement?
I think that is an overstatement, yes. Yeah. Okay. I think what we're witnessing right now is a moment where we have the capacity, the technology, to make the lives of these children visible. And with that has come outrage, because the ways in which those communities are treated and those children are treated is absolutely anathema to all of our values. Mm-hmm. But it's not the case there's any evidence that the problem is getting worse. In fact, there's just not that much evidence at all. That's been the issue.
So if it is not, as some believe, open season on black boys, what are we experiencing? Because you look at the data, at least those stories that make the news, and one gets the feeling, at least, that something is amiss.
That's right. What we're seeing is a problem that's been going on for a really long time. Mm-hmm. But you said the key words. We look at the data. But the data that we've got is terrible. Uh-huh. There are no national data whatsoever on police behavior. We don't know how many people get stopped, pedestrian stops, mm-hmm. just walking, stopped in their car. We have no idea how often or how severe police use of force is anywhere, because we just don't have it. Mm-hmm. That's been a huge part of the problem. So I'm glad that we're taking these moments to try and collect some of that data. That's what the Center for Policing Equity is mm-hmm. principally doing this year, is create the first national database on that. But the fact that it's the first, and it's happening now in 2015, that's an American embarrassment.
So how do you create a database without the cooperation of institutions and departments?
You don't.
Yeah.
And I think the good news race story on this has been that police departments came to us mm-hmm. and they said, frankly, one of them in particular said, we have been, like Eric Holder said, we were a nation of cowards. We've been a profession of cowards. We don't want to know that we're the worst or that we're worse than the police department over there. We don't like being compared to each other. But we need to know this if we're ever going to make a difference. And this was right after Trayvon Martin. They asked for it, and they said, would you please put a national database together that we can trust? And that's where it came from. People are opting in. There's no federal requirement to get into mm-hmm. it, but people are jumping over themselves to try and get into a database so that they can know, where are we and how do we get better from here?
You say jumping over themselves. I asked a question to begin this conversation, whether or not you thought it was an overstatement. Is that an overstatement? Are people, departments that is, that anxious to find this out?
So just last week we announced, mm-hmm. The Attorney General announced yeah. the 6 pilot sites for the national initiative to build public trust and justice, community okay. trust and justice. I can tell you that when one of the U.S. attorneys from one of the sites that was picked found out that they had been selected for an intervention to help their police department get better, the chief and the U.S. attorney were both in tears on the phone. They so desperately wanted to do better on this. Mm-hmm. So it's not an overstatement. It would be an overstatement to say that every department is. Mm-hmm. Right? There are lots of departments that would rather be far away from this. And we're talking about police, not sheriffs. Now, there are sheriff's departments that want to be involved, but there's a big difference between the two. You'll mm-hmm. note I don't ever talk about some of the people that are in the news for doing the worst among this profession. Mm-hmm. Those folks aren't jumping all over themselves. But the vast majority of especially large cities, they're led by chiefs and executives that really want to do the right thing, and they're pulling out their hair. They're banging their heads against the wall because it's harder than just having the right principles.
If they are that concerned and that disturbed to the point of tears on a telephone phone call, why hasn't more been done heretofore? Why did it take, whether or not it's been overstated or not, why did it take Tamir Rice and Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and Eric Garner, and I could go on and on and on, why did it take all that if they were that concerned?
That, I think, is a fair question. Mm-hmm. You can be really concerned about a thing, but if you don't have a direction, then it's real hard to move. I've been using this sort of both in my own sort of Bible study and in the work that I do. Mm-hmm. Proverbs 29:18, where there is no vision, the people perish. Yeah. But you know that's a mistranslation from mm-hmm. the Hebrew, because it doesn't actually say perish. The Hebrew word for it is para, mm-hmm. which means to be shaken loose. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have a vision for how you're going to move forward, then you end up getting shaken loose from that plan. So I think what we've actually had is we've had a new generation of chiefs come in that say, we want to do right, we want to do better. we want to trust in evidence-based approaches. But the urgency has not been there on the national level. The funding hasn't been there. Mm-hmm. And the vision for what better looks like hasn't been there. They have a couple ideas, but it's not to radically reshape the department. And now I think what's happened in the wake of all these tragedies, they have the license to go out and say, we're going to do something bold because bold action's needed to make sure that this stuff doesn't continue.
Let me go out on a limb, which really ain't much of a limb. But let me go out on a limb and predict to you that when the evidence-based data comes in, it's going to underscore that there is a bias against young black boys. Just a wild guess.
You're courageous.
So when we discover that I am right, then what? Because it's one thing to be anxious for the data, but when the data reveals that y'all been acting and behaving in some ugly ways, even though you're sworn to protect and serve, then what?
Great question. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm a scientist, and we're a long way from knowing all the things they need to do. So I can't give you the full map. Mm-hmm. But we do know some things that definitely work. We know, for instance, as not just a religious principle or a statement of values, but a scientific fact, that cooperation and compliance with the law begins with trust in it and not fear of it. And when you train police that their job is not to inspire fear of deterrence, but to inspire trust in community policing, that in fact crime goes down, reporting goes up, cleared cases go up, violence decreases. Right? So that's a thing that we can do. Mm-hmm. What I can tell you is that though we don't have the full roadmap, right, we're getting the map by getting the data. And what we're also able to tell you is that training is great and affecting hearts and minds is important. It's a part of our national character. But situations matter almost infinitely more than character at predicting anything. So we're going to have to change the policies and the incentive structures for law enforcement in order to get us to where we're trying to go to, which is reducing the disparities.
So we can't legislate morality. We can't legislate character. We can't legislate those kinds of ideals and virtues. And so I wonder to what extent these police departments, I don't want to paint all the broad brush, mm-hmm. as you suggested earlier, but these police forces that are out of control with this bias against young black boys, how much are they mirroring the bias that exists in the larger society? And if I'm right about, or I'm just asking a question, but if I'm right about this, then how do you root that out?
That is the $25 million question or whatever they're paying for it these days. One of the things that I like to make sure that I say whenever I'm going to a community meeting is, however furious you might be, I might be at local law enforortment, because we know that discrimination has taken place. This is racism. Let me call it what it is. It's not just bias. Mm-hmm. It's not implicit. It's racism. As much as we know that, why would we think for a second that if it exists in policing, it doesn't exist in employment, in education, mm-hmm. in healthcare, and in housing?
Or vice versa.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and if it exists all those mm-hmm. are going to be upstream from most of our contact with criminal justice system. How do we disaggregate that? National level data. Because mm-hmm. if we've got national level data with, you know, controlling for certain factors, you can say, well, it's actually the educational disparities that are the biggest predictor. And so we need to be focusing on that. Not to say we can't focus on law enforcement, mm-hmm. but we need to focus on that. And this is the percentage that belongs to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. This is the percentage that belongs to the employers.
I wonder whether or not you think, Professor Goff, that that data can make the difference for all the craving that there exists now, to your point, on the part of departments mm-hmm. for this data. Can data really make the difference? And I ask that because I can give you two or three issues right now that we talk about in the news every day mm-hmm. where the data isn't making a difference. Let's start with climate change. Let's go to global warming. Mm-hmm. Let's go to immigration. Let's go to, even when the data comes in, there are those who play politics with the numbers. Numbers don't lie, people do. Mm-hmm. And so can data make a difference?
Data is a tool, mm-hmm. right? Data doesn't lead inevitably to any particular thing, but it is a tool. And where we're at right now is a rare moment. When was the last time that communities of color got together with law enforcement and solved a racial problem mm-hmm. as opposed to constituting a racial problem? I am telling you, the vast majority of law enforcement executives, at least, the chiefs, they want to do better on this from a genuine place. Mm-hmm. And they believe that they can. They don't know the direction to go lots of times. So the data can be a tool if you've got the right heart and you've got the willingness to make a change.
So is there a way, before I let you go here, is there a way for us to follow the work that you're doing as you're doing it, or we have to wait until this reports come out?
So you can go to the National Initiative to Build Community Trust and Justice. So it's the Trust and Justice Initiative, trustandjustice.org. You can go to policingequity.org, and that's where the Center for Policing Equity work is. And those two places also have Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts. You can like us, you can follow us, and we're going to be eager to make sure the community has a voice in the research process, because they've not had a voice and access to the data up until now.
Let me treat the question I asked a moment ago to close our conversation. Are you hopeful that the data that will be produced can in fact make a difference in our society?
Without the data, we lack the tools to live lives that are consistent with our principles. Mm-hmm. With the data, we indict ourselves if we don't move forward on it.
Professor Philip Atiba-Goff doing great work, and I am delighted to have had him on the program to give you a sense of what they're working on here at UCLA and what the rest of us ought to be apprised of once that work is done. Good to have you on.
Thanks very much.
Good to see you, Professor. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Ann Hache was once my next-door neighbor, literally. I'm not sure if I ran her off, but she's been awfully busy since she left the neighborhood. She stars in a new project for the USA Network. It's called Dig. It's a 10-part action thriller murder mystery set against the backdrop of modern-day Jerusalem.
Okay, you're telling me that you can't ID any of them?
I was upside down. The car was totaled.
Why didn't you call for backup?
Because it was over before it started. They knew exactly where we were going to be.
The ambassador is hosting 100 people at the consulate for dinner tonight. Somebody's gonna ask about it. What am I gonna tell her to say?
Well, unfortunately, it gets a little worse.
Great. How?
The picture, the corrupted image, and of Emma Wilson and the suspect. I think Detective Cohen has figured out that it's me in the picture.
What do you mean?
I met her that night. I walked with her through the city.
All right, before I get into Dig, how is Homer?
Homer is terrific. Yeah. He would say hi. He says hi.
Tell Homer I said hello.
I sure will.
I miss Homer.
Well, Homer misses you. Yeah. Let's have a date. Let's have a Homer date.
Homer is Ann's son, who was my little next-door neighbor friend when he was in the neighborhood.
Now we have another mini one running around. Because now we have Atlas.
How old is Atlas?
He would be too loud. You really would kick us out if we were next door. Atlas is has quite a voice.
Yeah.
Let's say that.
So Homer and Atlas.
Homer and Atlas. They both had their birthdays this week. Homer turned 13, Atlas turned 6.
What's Homer doing now?
Well, he's beating up on his brother.
But he's not doing that.
He's doing a lot of schoolwork. You know, 7th grade is a big year, a lot of transition.
What's he do for fun?
For fun, he plays a lot of tennis, and now he's on the tennis team at school, which is very exciting.
Good for him.
See a second match
Good
today.
For him. Tell him I said hello.
I sure will.
All right, so that's it for Homer and Atlas now.
All right, forget
them. To Dig. Talk about this series.
Well, I loved your setup. I mean, it really is a mystery conspiracy thriller. Kind of in the Da Vinci Code meets Indiana Jones kind of world. It takes a lot of paying attention. Yeah. There are a lot of storylines that kind of come together. One that starts in Norway where a calf is being born. You don't understand why. One in Jerusalem where an American is murdered. And another in takes place in a compound where a child is being raised whose feet hasn't touched the ground yet. And we don't know why all of these are coming together. And of course, as we start, I'm the head of the FBI in Jerusalem. Peter Connolly, my partner, and I start looking into the murder. And of course, discover that there is a conspiracy of 2,000 years in the making.
So this local stuff really becomes an international sort of conspiracy and drama.
Well, I think one of the things, Gideon Raff is one of the creators who created Homeland, Tim Kring, who created Heroes. The two of them kind of came together. I think Gideon really loves to tap into the complexities of world issues that are going on and then turning them into, you know, mysteries. And of course, this is not a documentary, but it does take place in the Middle East and all of the questions that are going on about that place and about Jerusalem over the thousands of years are certainly part of the story and the mystery.
Yeah. I was going to ask, and you've in part answered, but more expressly, why Jerusalem? I mean, when I saw this as a, it's cable, but it's a TV series.
Yes.
I think that must have been a huge budget, not that these folks don't have the money, but to go to Jerusalem to film, and I mean, why Jerusalem?
A very big deal. Gideon is from there.
Right.
But they wanted something that would uncover a mystery that literally is rooted in truths that are going on, both religious and and metaphysical. Yeah. And Jerusalem is, of course, the part of the planet that is most fought over for centuries. So,
how much two questions about Jerusalem. How much of a character is Jerusalem in the series?
Very much so. Yeah. Our whole first episode was shot there. Right. Some people were there for 3 months. I was there for 6 weeks shooting the whole first episode, which is an hour and a half special. And then, of course, the conflict broke out in Gaza again. And we had to relocate.
I was about to ask.
Yeah, so then we went to Croatia.
You guys had to stop filming.
Well, we were taking a hiatus at the at that particular moment. Right. We were planning to take a hiatus. Right. But then, yeah, we did not, nor did any other production go back and start shooting there season.
So you start shooting where?
And then we went to Croatia.
Croatia, yeah. Oh.
It has been quite a journey. This is a 10-episode series, and it has taken almost a year to shoot, which, to put into context, 10 episodes of normal television shows take maybe 12 to 14 weeks.
Yeah.
And this took about a year. Every episode is like a film, and you really have to, and you should watch it like a movie.
Yeah. I think I know the answer, but let me ask anyway. I assume that all of that drama, when you saw the end product, it was worth it? It was worth all of that year to get?
Oh, I have to tell you, I was cheering. I waited and waited because there are so many different cuts and so many different locations and so many different incarnations of the project. I waited to see it until last week with an entire audience of 600 people. We were in New York City. And they showed it on a big screen. And I was in awe. It was better than what I think they had even aimed for. It was as intense and meaningful and dramatic as what they wanted. And this is a lot of focus and dedication from both USA and our creators, Tim and Gideon. So.
You mentioned that your character is the head of the FBI in Jerusalem. Tell me more about your character.
Well, I'm a legal attaché. So not to give too much away, but there is a legal attaché for Americans in every country, stationed in every country, to help whether Americans are involved in a crime, both as the what they need to be defended or supported.
Uh-huh.
So this is why we come into the story. Lynn is there. Peter used to be her boss in America. He's now going through an emotional trauma, calls her and says, I need to come over and I need to get out of America.
Uh-huh.
He comes over and the two of them kind of start working together again. She is his boss. And again, go after, you know, understanding the truths of this American that is murdered. And then all of these other stories unfold around it.
What was the experience like for you? I mean, nowadays, I mean, so many of us are into binge watching these kinds of series on a variety.
Yes, I think people will get into the same kind of binge watching this for sure.
Yeah. So I was about to ask, how did you like doing a series that has a beginning, has an end? It's a 10-part piece. How did you like that?
Well, it's pretty fantastic because the story woven together is there is no open end. They knew exactly what was going to happen. I just said, don't tell me what's going to happen this week. As long as I don't die, I don't want to know. Let me be like the audience and really take it. Because once you think the story is going to go somewhere, it goes someplace else. Once you think you understand a person is a good person, they end up being bad. You know, it's a real fun mystery in that way.
But how does it help you as an actor not knowing the next episode?
Because if I'm sitting with you and I think you're a good person, but the director has told me that you're actually bad, I'm such a bad actress that my whole face will just be like, you're bad. You're just bad. I can't pretend you're good.
Right.
You can read me. I mean, that's the good and bad of me as an actress. So I said, just hold off so that I can be equally as surprised or mad or whatever I need to be as Lynn each week as I find out who's who.
So any of those surprises from week to week that you did not want to know about disappoint you?
Then they weren't disappointing, I was shocking.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and that's, of course, the, you know, that's what you want.
Yeah, yeah.
Show. You don't want to be like, oh, darn.
Yeah.
No, they're shocking, shocking revelations.
Yeah. What is it about this particular genre, these kind of murder mysteries after hundreds of years that still just get us, we get pulled in every time?
I know. Yeah. We want to know. I think we like to be the detective.
Yeah.
Or be smarter than everybody else, or have figured it out. And I think that is what draws us in. Of course, you want to look at the whole thing. Homer came in the other day, actually, and was looking at a show that Homer was watching, and he said, I already know who the bad guy is.
Yeah.
And it was for the movie Big Hero 6, and I was like, how do you... He knows, he's like, oh, no, it's that guy.
Yeah.
And of course he wants to know that, but I happened to watch Big Hero 6, so I knew that it wasn't that guy.
Yeah.
And I think, oh, see, that's it. He's already in.
Right.
Because if I say to him, that's not it...
Yeah.
And that's exactly what's going to happen with Dig. You go, there's no way that person is, and that person is.
Yeah. There's a reason why they call it Dig. I should ask you why they named it
Dig. They keep saying dig deeper, what lies beneath. You know, the deeper you go, the more you uncover the untruths, you know. And And it is that. And also, I mean, there is quite truly an archaeological dig that is going on in Jerusalem. The woman, I'm sure you've seen the billboards with the redheaded girl with a symbol carved into her back. There is an archaeology story. They are digging underneath in the Holy Land. And in getting very close to Holy Land and all that is precious to many religions, they get closer and closer to these conspiracies as the conspiracies are coming in from outside to get underneath.
Had you been to Jerusalem prior to shooting this?
I had not.
What did you make of it?
I thought it was absolutely beautiful. When you go, I mean, we were welcomed in as a crew, obviously, to shoot there, and it's not something I didn't know. You are aware of the conflict. You are aware of what's going on, how many people care about Jerusalem in particular. And when you're there, you feel that. It was very important for me to go. I feel very blessed that I was even asked to go. I don't know if it would have been the trip that I thought my family was going to take. Come on, guys, we're going to go to the Middle East for our summer vacation. And then it turned out to be absolutely extraordinary. We went to Bethlehem. We went to Jaffa. We went, I mean, we really explored. We went to the Sea of Galilee. I never thought I would take my children there. And then, of course, because we were so close, we were able to go to Greece as well, which was absolutely spectacular. So it turned out to be quite amazing. We did go to the Wailing Wall, of course. And what I didn't understand was that there are the men go to one side and the women go to the other. And, of course, it's a place of mourning, but also incredible celebration. There were brides and grooms and the notes on the wall. It's a stunning thing to behold. And as we stood there, basically taking in this world, this the emotion, that that really touched me. And Homer said, I want to go touch the wall. And to watch my son, James and I were standing there with Atlas, and we watched he's 12, he just turned 13, but he was 12. It was, and you have to go around the steps, and then you have to go and join the men and become a part of the, it's like a processional, in a way. I watched him.
A communal processional.
And wept. And he went up, and he said it was, for him, it was meaningful. We didn't ask him to explain, but he said it was powerful and meaningful and what he needed to do. It was just, you know, it was a holy moment.
Homer's growing up. That's a long way from a two-year-old splashing in the pool next to my house to going to Israel, to Jerusalem to touch the wall. I love it. It's a great story. I'm glad Homer went. I'm glad Atlas went. I'm glad James went. But I'm especially glad that you went. Because out of your going comes this new series for USA Network. It's called Dig, starring one Anne Heche. Good to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so nice to see you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.